Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
During the early 1800s, something was happening in London, and in fact all over the UK, which would change the face of things forever. The Industrial Revolution was bringing people kicking and screaming into the future, and people were facing things they'd never encountered before. The world was changing at a rapid rate. Factory working became a whole new way of life for the majority of people, and as this was the first time this had ever happened, there seemingly were no rules. This change to employment meant those that had once worked for themselves had to work for others. Pair this with food prices becoming exorbitant and working conditions becoming deadly. People wanted to have their say. However, the vote was only for the rich, and people were growing angry at the growing divide, which would lead to an inciting event that would change the future. But would it be for better or for worse? Today on Macabre London, we uncover the beginnings of the suffrage movement and the Peterloo Massacre. And welcome back to another episode of Macabre London. I'm Nikki Druce, your host with the silent G, and today I'll be taking you on a journey down another of London's grimy backstreets to uncover a macabre tale from the city's past. And today we're headed feet first into an industrial revolution and exploring an event which would be the catalyst for revolutionary change for people in the UK. But first, if you're new here and you want to see more videos where we deep dive into historic tales from London's past and sometimes all over the world, then please don't forget to subscribe or follow so you never miss a new episode. If you like what I make and have done for a while now, I have a Patreon where you can get more of the show. There's my extra show on Patreon called Having a Problem, which is lots of silly fun with a bit of history thrown in, and I just posted an update about what's coming up this year on the show over there too if you want to check it out. I'd love to see you over there. It really is the best way to support what I make to make sure the show can continue, and surely there's no harm in taking a look. Pop over to patreon.com/macabre London. Around the mid-18th century, the Industrial Revolution began on the farms and rural lands which once peppered the landscape of England. In the UK, and Europe for that matter, the way of life back then was remote. People lived in small villages or market towns which were a bit larger, and the population was spread out across the landscape. There were a few larger cities, but these were nothing like what they have become in the modern day, and would have been more like little towns. These rural homesteads served as people's lifelong homes. The option to travel wasn't there, as it was simply unavailable unless you wanted to be on horseback for days on end, which was very uncomfortable and also required you to have enough money for a horse in the first place. This meant that over time, as farming practices became better and technology advanced, the populations of the towns started to slowly increase. With better provisions, people lived longer and there was enough food, clothing and shelter to go around. This increase soon began to rise sharply when there were enough people to work the land, and more people meant the improvements just kept coming. As time ticked by, the combination of more people plus better tools and mechanised farming techniques meant even more food, and the way of life that had happened for hundreds of years via peasant farming was becoming a distant memory. Now, of course, as these advances were made, people decided that what was once general land, which was used by many to just simply grow crops and raise livestock, had to belong to someone. The enclosure movement was brought in, which meant common lands used for agriculture became private property, and landowners took away a lot of the opportunity for the general village folk to raise their own livestock and grow crops. This added instant pressure to the general public, and so they had to work more in order to be able to buy the food that was once free. Now, that's not to say that there wasn't money before then, but the lifestyle back then was far more rural, and this change turned it into an occupation. At this time, cities did exist, but they weren't as we know them today. They were somewhat more advanced in terms of what they had to offer, but over the next 100 years, they would change exponentially. As the city started to evolve and had more job opportunities, many people ditched the rural lifestyle, which had become unsustainable, and descended in droves to the larger towns. This meant that even larger market towns grew in size, and boom towns began to erupt across the country. This growth was rapid. In 1800, around 20% of Brits lived in cities, but by the middle of the century, that had increased to around 50% of a population of 30 million across the whole country, making it the largest influx into cities that has ever been seen in Europe. As factory production rapidly emerged, everyone had the opportunity to be employed, and this meant places like Leeds, Manchester, and Liverpool became burgeoning hubs of industry. London was, of course, the leader, and people in their millions descended on the capital and created the urbanised city we know and love today. This rapid expansion meant society was having to reorganise itself. This type of city, living on such a grand scale, had never happened before. On one hand, it was a prosperous, pioneering and exciting time, but on the other, it was unknown, unsettling and disruptive to the way of life people had known for their entire existence. Society hadn't really changed much in terms of growth for hundreds of years, and this truly was the start of the future for the UK and would change the way people lived forever. Factories began to dominate the landscape, and the rate at which resources, materials, and products could be made was expedited. Individual production of items was now obsolete, and machines took over. Watermills and livestock were done away with, and steam power became the newfangled way forward. This robbed many skilled workers of their profession, landing them in factories where the machines set the pace. The fact that machines were indefatigable in their efforts meant that the workers had to match their pace. People worked very long hours with no rest days at all. The conditions were often dismal, damaging to health, and often people were worked to death. This rapid increase in production wasn't limited to adults either. Children as young as 4 were put in factories, and their small stature was often exploited, sent into machinery to fix things, risking their lives, and those lucky enough to survive were doomed to do nothing but work long hours for the rest of their days with nothing to look forward to but the grave. Families had once worked alongside each other at perhaps a country estate or in tandem with other families on a small holding or farm and shared the produce and output. The labour at home was spread across the family, but with this new way of working, there was no time left to complete such tasks. This led to many families moving into shared accommodation in order to share the workload, and often women bore the brunt of the situation, as men were more desirable in the workforce and they earned more, making wives and their children financially dependent on them. This in turn meant that men were not only now responsible for earning money, but they were working all hours of the day and being absent for familial responsibilities. Of those families that moved to the city, they at least had a chance of seeing each other, but for many men which moved to the boom towns, they just sent money home and were often not seen for months, and sometimes even years on end. That's if they survived working 16-hour days, 7 days a week. Now, all of this doesn't mean that women didn't work, because they did. Some worked from home making textiles or sold street food such as oysters, or did simple cleaning or seamstress work on top of their household duties and childcare. Younger girls or unmarried women made up the majority of domestic servant roles, and textile mills mopped up the rest. This primarily female occupation also swept in young children, and their small hands were used to thread machines. Nowadays, we still have a huge disparity in pay when it comes to gender, and this is where it all began. Women and children working in the textile mills were paid a tiny amount compared to their male counterparts, simply because this type of work was seen as unskilled compared to men working in mines, building railways, or constructing trains. Now, I like to think that even though it takes a hell of a lot of skill to build a train, it also requires the same ingenuity to be able to weave a blanket or embroider intricate lace. In fact, the two things aren't even comparable, so this was clearly just an excuse to diminish the importance of women's work and a way to pick on the marginalised. The work still encountered similar dangers to men's work, and the hours were just as long, if not longer, as work could be done after dark inside. As the horrors of this new way of working emerged, it became blatantly obvious to those running the factories and production lines that they could exploit everyone involved in the system and get rich off the back of others' suffering. The working classes had no other choice but to take it on the chin. But after 50 years of abuse and generational impact, they eventually decided enough was enough. If the cyclical nature of work was disrupted and profits plummeted, the working class would be able to show that they indeed demanded respect and their value was worth investing in. By the early 20th century, the plight of workers rose and they demanded more from their employers. Better working conditions, breaks and improved pay were all fought for, and a simple strike simply wouldn't be enough. If they wanted to be taken seriously, they had to show the government and their employers what they were made of. However, the first eruption of this mistreatment didn't begin in London. It sprang up in Manchester. During the first half of the 19th century, groups had begun popping up that were for the benefit of workers and protested on their behalf, highlighting the poor conditions many were finding themselves in and making sure people didn't settle for it. These groups would often tour around the country, drumming up support of the plight and disseminating the news that was coming out of London. One such speaker for these workers' rights was Henry Hunt. Henry was a pioneer of working class radicalism. He believed in equality for all, fair remuneration, and safe working conditions. And on a visit to Manchester, he became embroiled in something which would mark the start of the change to workers' rights. During January 1819, civil unrest amongst Manchester's workers was simmering. The Tory Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, had imposed a new restriction on imported grains called the Corn Laws. These laws placed severe restrictions on imported food and as such made it incredibly expensive, meaning the poor couldn't afford it. I can't say I'm surprised, the Tories have been doing this to the poor for literally hundreds of years. There had been several calm protests about this, and also just the general awfulness of life as a factory worker, and Henry Hunt had got wind of the discontent and made his way to be with those he sympathised with. Anyone who had protested in the weeks leading up to Henry's arrival had been read the Riot Act, an actual document back then and not just a saying, which stated gatherings of over more than 12 people with a political emphasis would be considered a riot regardless, and all participants would be arrested and imprisoned. Again, in the present day, the Tories have slowly been eroding the right to protest, but remember, it is your right if you live in the UK under the European Convention on Human Rights to protest peacefully. However, I won't mention every comparison to the modern day that the Tories are still upholding, or else we'll be here all day, but it sure makes for an interesting comparison, doesn't it? Anyway, the initial protesters in Manchester were indeed arrested after protesting peacefully and placed in prison. This act to silence the public acknowledgement of poor workers' conditions didn't go unnoticed, and if anything, it drew far more attention to their plight. Not long after, 10,000 people gathered at St Peter's Fields, and these meetings went on for months, drumming up support and interest and growing in size. As time ticked by, the message of these mass gatherings trickled back to London, and the government were aware that if they didn't act, something big was going to happen, which would ultimately affect their control over the general population as a whole. Working with the cavalry, the government found a legal loophole which would allow them to act with violence against the next gathering, and so they set out with intention to disturb the peace of the protesters, and to send a statement to the rest of the country that this kind of thing would not be tolerated any further. Henry Hunt led the gathering on the 17th of August, inviting anyone who wanted to speak to do so, allowing the marginalised to have their voices heard. Speeches were given by many workers, which spanned the breadth of those working in the factories, and unlike all voices heard that time on the subject, Henry also invited women to speak, giving them a literal platform to voice the inequalities they were facing. The Manchester Female Reform Society had been devised just a few weeks earlier in July of 1819, and within a week of starting the organisation, they had 1,000 members registered. When the rally happened in August, Henry had invited the President, Mary Fields, and Secretary Susanna Saxton to join him on the platform as equals and to say their piece. As speeches were being heard and the crowd reached its peak of around 80,000 attendees, some of which had marched en masse in their thousands from nearby towns, such as Rochdale and Stockport, the peace was disrupted, and what was about to happen would start a chain of events which would change the future of the common man, not necessarily for the better. But before we head down that route, this seems to be a good time to tell you about another fantastic podcast which I think you're really going to love. The Art of Crime is a history podcast about the unlikely collisions between true crime and the arts. The latest season is titled Queen of Crime, Madame Tussauds, and the Chamber of Horrors. I've been listening as the season has been unfolding, and the show is so well written and a really fascinating listen, which is teaching me a lot I didn't realise about Marie, but also the time period in France. If you're enjoying this episode's social history elements, you're really going to love listening to this one. Queen of Crime tells two stories. First, it chronicles Tussauds' long and distinguished career, starting in pre-revolutionary France and ending in Victorian London. Second, it tracks the evolution of the Chamber of Horrors, a showroom in her wax museum that exhibited macabre curiosities, including effigies of notorious criminals. You'll hear how Tussauds won patronage from the French royal family, narrowly escaped the Reign of Terror, and became one of the most celebrated showwomen in the whole of London. You'll also learn about the most divisive assassin of the French Revolution, the last man to be hung, drawn and quartered for high treason in England, and the glamorous murderer who attained notoriety as a modern Lady Macbeth. Subscribe to The Art of Crime wherever you get your podcasts and join me in listening along.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch. Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Now, let's get back to the episode. Around 700 constables had been at the speech since the beginning of the day and were there to observe but didn't yet cause any disruption. However, local factory owners and the chief magistrate were watching the event from a nearby house which overlooked Peter's Fields. When they heard the crowds enthusiastically cheering and agreeing with the speakers, they decided they'd had enough and wanted to claw back the power they felt they were losing. The chief magistrate issued orders for the local cavalry to descend onto the field to disperse the crowd with immediate effect. The men who were waiting for their expected orders were chomping at the bit to get into the crowd and immediately acted with violence. The protesters were told before the event by Henry Hunt to only come armed with no other weapon but that of a self-approving conscience. They were also told to dress well, and many turned out in their Sunday best. The crowd came to make an eloquent point and knew that even a hint at rioting would befit the excuse the authorities were looking for so they could attack and arrest as many people as possible. When the cavalry were called to the field, they were quick to descend. One yeoman on the way acted with reckless abandon and dangerously galloped his horse down the street, ploughing down a woman and her two-year-old son. Anne Fields and her son William had been in the area running errands and weren't part of the protest, but sadly for the Fields family, William would become the first victim that day as he died from his injuries. When the cavalry arrived at St. Peter's Fields, they didn't waste any time in advancing on the crowd. Their initial instructions were to arrest first and foremost Henry Hunt and several other speakers. As they pushed their way into the crowd, still on horseback, people stood strong. They tried to make it impossible for the horses to pass, but the men began swiping at people with their sabres and shouting at them to move. As soon as the first few blows were issued by the cavalry, the scene erupted into a violent mess. The cavalry were merciless at who they attacked, with women, older children, and older crowd members all being swiped at with swords. The constables also began to wade in and began beating the crowd with their truncheons, rendering several people injured or unconscious. With this merciless attack on the crowd underway, people began to panic. The mix of horses, swords, and flailing limbs became a huge mess. The exits from the field were restricted by police, and as they pushed from the outside, the cavalry was causing carnage in the middle. As people tried to run, they fell. Many were crushed, and horses crashed down on top of them. One onlooker said as people tried to break free, they were streaked with blood, children were crying, and jubilant flags, which were once flying in defiance, were now being used to stem the bleeding from many wounds. The indiscriminate attack went on for 10 minutes, and people were left dead or dying on the field, and hundreds were injured. Eventually, the manoeuvre was called off as the authorities were finding themselves overpowered by the now incensed crowd, and they had no other option but to retreat. Those that weren't injured were now incredibly riled up by the attack, and they instantly began rioting in the surrounding streets. Shops which were owned by factory owners were smashed and looted, and the crowd was out for revenge. The rioting continued into the following day, and in other surrounding towns, civil unrest popped up when the news had spread of the unjust massacre on St. Peter's Fields. The next day, Still not satisfied that those who had died had been adequately avenged, a special constable, Robert Campbell, who had been sworn in to specifically police the protest in Manchester, was hunted down and dragged from his home. Protesters entered his property and took Constable Campbell outside, where an assembled group beat and kicked him in a vicious attack which took his life. This one life was a token sacrifice for those that died the day previously, but also for the many that would die subsequently from their injuries. With the civil unrest dispersing and people returning to their homes, the streets of Manchester became deathly quiet for the next few days. The Peterloo Massacre was a huge shock to the area's population and also the authorities. However, the local authorities weren't being quiet out of respect. They were waiting, hoping to arrest those involved. Those that were injured were having to hide their wounds, as factory owners had been told that anyone who arrived at work with injuries should be turned into the local council for appropriate punishment. This meant many people didn't return to their jobs in solidarity with their injured colleagues, and those that did, and who proudly displayed their battle scars, were either arrested or sacked, or in some cases, both. Speakers were tracked down and imprisoned, including Henry Hunt, but others managed to evade capture. Over the next few weeks and months, the true horrors of what occurred at the Peterloo Massacre would become apparent. Those that had sustained serious injuries began to pass away, leaving the death toll at a suspected 18 victims in total. But the true number will never be known, as some people had long-term crush injuries and others incurred life-changing injuries, which over time contributed to their early deaths. Those that were imprisoned suffered terrible treatment, and the government made sure these political prisoners were served lessons that would be remembered for a lifetime. Mary Fields was attacked at the field by a member of the cavalry who slashed her twice with a sabre. She was then set upon by a special constable who beat her with a truncheon. However, another policeman intervened from what may have escalated to a fatal attack and escorted Mary away from the field. But in the meantime, the constable which had delivered her beating had taken the flag Mary had used on the day and subsequently passed it on to a shop owner who displayed it as a macabre memento in the window immediately following the event. Understandably, this gloating token wasn't taken well by the downtrodden rebels, and the shop was smashed to pieces. Mary managed to leave the field without being arrested, and she went into hiding for 2 weeks, tending to her substantial injuries. Over the course of the next week, other women who had been on St. Peter's Fields were arrested. Some speculate this was because the authorities were trying to track down Mary. Other female reformers who weren't able to hide or who had no intention of doing so were Elizabeth Gaunt, Sarah Hargreaves, and Mary Waterworth, all of whom were arrested. On her imprisonment, Elizabeth Gaunt, who was heavily pregnant, was kept in solitary confinement and given regular correctional abuse at the hands of her prison guards. Now, the details are hazy about the other women's arrest and treatment they received, but at least 3 miscarriages and 1 premature birth, which led to the death of the mother, the premature baby did survive though, were attributed to the Peterloo Massacre. And as women were in fewer numbers in the crowd, it seemed to the onlookers that they were being directly targeted on the field that day by the constables and cavalry. One ex-soldier who had been on the field with the protesters that day was a man named John Lees. John, who later died from his wounds sustained by a sabre wound around a month after the initial attack, said what happened at St. Peter's Fields was worse than anything he'd seen in battle. Lees had fought at the Battle of Waterloo, one of the bloodiest battles to have ever occurred, and so he was well versed in combat. He said to a friend a few days before he died, "At Waterloo, there was man to man, but there it was downright murder." So, once the dust had settled a few weeks on from the Peterloo Massacre, the authorities were frightened. This had been just a small demonstration of the unhappiness of the working classes. They outnumbered the authorities in their thousands, and it seemed the common man wasn't going to take it for much longer. If things were to erupt again on a much larger scale, those in power wouldn't stand a chance, and a mass uprising was apparently on the cards. The government had to work out if they would loosen the reins on the public and provide them with what they asked for, or bear down harder to regain control. Firstly, a short while after Peterloo, they did give payments to the families of those killed on the day, but these were meagre at best, with the most equating to around £350 in today's money. Other small payments were made to those injured, did actually receive one of these payments, which she accepted, and strangely, she wasn't arrested as a result. Neighbourhoods made things to sell to raise funds for those injured, including tankards, handkerchiefs, medals for those who were involved or who supported the plight, and commemorative plates were sold to display as a reminder. With journalism now a more prevalent occupation, the word of what happened at Peterloo spread up and down the country and into the rest of the UK. A pamphlet produced about the massacre was continually printed for 14 weeks and it sold out every single time. These pamphlets made their way around every pub, factory and market, and the public outcry was enormous. People were dismayed at what had happened, and the systematic annihilation of the working man was, well, not taken well. As civilians began to continually gather to speak about reform, universal suffrage, and a general better way of life overall, the government panicked and the crackdown came. Things quickly became worse than they had been before. Reform activities were outlawed completely by the government, and police were instructed to nip anything of that type in the bud. Journalists were imprisoned, and police continually raided printing presses and ultimately put many papers out of print due to fines and destruction of equipment. Court cases against the cavalry brought by injured protesters were thrown out due to insufficient evidence, and it was ruled that the yeomen were acting in self-defence from a violent crowd. The Prince Regent, George IV, also commended the actions of the authorities in keeping the peace. The general public already didn't like the prince for other reasons which I've covered on a previous episode, which if you haven't listened to it, you definitely should. Just to give you a little precursor of what it's all about, it's called The Princess Who Was Too Smelly to Marry, so make sure you have a look. But anyway, this ignorant comment made the general public feel abandoned by everyone in the upper echelons of society. It meant now it was time for action. Several conspiracies of rebellion occurred across the country and were discovered and foiled by the police. One in particular, the Cato Street Conspiracy, had plans to blow up the cabinet. Within a few months, the government enacted a new law, the Six Acts, which meant that by the end of the year, anyone who was even suspected of thinking about reform was put in prison. This harshening of laws meant that the conditions for workers were about to become much worse, and so began a bitter decade of battles which would force the true underdogs of the working classes to fight tooth and nail to get exactly what they wanted. And this timeline would be extended even further for the most downtrodden at that time, working class women. It was now time for deeds, not words. Now, if you usually skip to the end here, please stay listening for just a minute longer. I've had a few messages recently saying there are a few things you didn't realise about the show, and that will be why, because it's usually all here at the end. Firstly, thanks for joining me for this episode. I hope you'll agree it's a really interesting and important part of history that is often overlooked, and I'm so excited to begin revealing the next segments to this tale as we go. I know lots of you have asked me for more classic London stories, and as we know, I don't really do classic history here, but what I do love is telling people's stories. Deeper dives are something you've been crying out for, and I'm listening to what you're saying and delivering on that promise. thanks for all the lovely words about last week's Mythbusters episode. Message received, you'd like more of them, so don't worry, I'll be working on it, and I can't wait to share with you the next instalment of this story. Okay, so to make the next bits quick, I have a Patreon with extra content that if you want to, you can sign up to, and that's the best way to support the show. I have a YouTube channel, it's called Macabre London as well, and you get way more from watching the episodes over there, as firstly, you get to see me host the show, hello if you're here, and I add in extra media that helps support the story and bring it to life. You often get to see who was involved and also plenty of London images. A big thanks to my amazing top tier legendary executive Patreon producers, Christina, Christoph, Kate, Lisa, Mary, Ravel, Rose, Sally, Sam, Sarah, Terry, Teresa, V and Veronica, and all of our other patrons too. If you'd also like your name read out by me at the end of every episode or your name in the show notes, then signing up to Patreon is the way to make that happen. I hope to see you over there at patreon.com/macabre London so I can personally welcome you to the Ghoul Gang. And lastly, thanks very much to The Art of Crime for sponsoring this episode. Make sure you check them out wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me for another macabre tale from London's past. I've been Nikki Druce. Remember to stay spooky, and I'll see you ghouls next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.